So in my teenage years, I used to play Magic the Gathering quite a bit, and that was going out to stores to play in weekly events and playing in tournaments and shit like that. And I didn't play a hell of a lot. When I was younger, I did play a lot more than I do now, and it was more kind of like a monthly, fortnightly, and then maybe like a quarterly playing in like a serious competitive tournament of like 50, 60 people. And for the most part in those tournaments, I did quite well early on, considering how often I did play and how seriously I took it, which was pretty casually at the time. To kind of fill it in a bit, so the normal sort of structure of these sorts of tournaments is you'll have 3 or 4 rounds where you'll just play off against different people, and it'll be done based on a priority of the weight of your score, essentially. So if you win a game, and there's 3 games in a round potentially, then you get X amount of points, and then if you lose a game, you only get 1 point, kind of thing. So, essentially, if you win, you get 3, if you lose, you get 1, and then it takes like a weighting based on the total points that you scored during a round, and you match off against similar position players in the next round. So, basically, the winners play against more winning players, and the losers play against more losing players. And then this will continue for 3 or 4 rounds until they decide they have enough of a separation and people have had enough of a chance to play, normally about 3 rounds. And then at that point, what they do is they will split off the what they call the top 8, or the highest performing players, and then they will basically everyone else goes home and those top players play off for like a final standing, or like a first, second, and third style awards ceremony, essentially. Now, at the time, I was quite young and didn't really think too much of it, but I did manage to get into the top 8 position, which essentially meant that I would be playing against other people for, at that particular event, a chance to go overseas and perform in a bigger tournament, essentially. So pretty much like the dude who wins the top 8 gets an invitation to attend the bigger tournament. So at this point, I was playing some games, and the competitiveness had kind of changed a little bit because I was still kind of doing well. And it's at this point that people would start using less than honest ways to kind of get advantages in the game, including essentially intentionally misinterpreting decisions that I was making in order to slightly warp it in their favor, and also including just flat out just asking if I would like to concede in exchange for some form of percentage of the prize. Now, because I was just a kid playing a card game casually, I honestly didn't give a shit, and I just kept playing as normal. I just turned down his offer and just said, "No, let's just keep playing," and we did. And over time, as he was getting more and more desperate, he started to basically misinterpret more and more things and try to subtly cheat and do things that were kind of lightly against the rules, or getting slight advantages, or just doing weird shit that was just dishonest, essentially. And he eventually turned the game around and started winning, and then naturally just acting like a cocky bastard and yeah, just being very excited that he had not needed to try to force his opponent to concede in order to make it through to a essential professional level of play, or get an invite to the tournament, kind of thing. And after that game, I didn't do so well, so I ended up playing more casual players after that, And it was a world of difference, and they weren't complete dicks about it. So, yeah, it was basically more of a one-off to do with that player or that breed of player, and just what they wanted out of the outcome of the tournament versus what I wanted, which was just to play and have fun. So, what would have happened if I went along with it and basically just conceded in exchange for a prize? Well, the outcome would not have been any different for either of us, except the game would have ended a lot quicker and he would have won by default, essentially, and I would have colluded in it. Now, the game Old School RuneScape was kind of like a fork in development from the main RuneScape game, and now Old School RuneScape is essentially a RuneScape 2 or old new RuneScape, and RuneScape 3, the original game, just decided to continue going down its development path and is still called RuneScape, but people refer to it as RuneScape 3. So what ended up happening was there was a series of snowball-y updates that just made the game worse and worse overall until there was essentially a max exodus of players, and at that point it was basically too late to revert the changes, and they just kept going down that route anyway. So there was stuff like a economy blocking update, which was the removal of free trade, which meant that you could only exchange or trade with players in similar sorts of value. So you couldn't just give a player millions and millions of GP without getting something in return. And then there was some changes done to the wilderness, which is that massive PvP area. And then there was also some changes made to probably the biggest indicator, which was the evolution of combat, or like so basically some updates which fundamentally significantly changed the way that the combat system was used in the game to interact with anything, combat-wise, essentially. And then one of the accompanying updates at around that sort of time was something called the Squeal of Fortune, which essentially is you get a certain number of spins or tickets each day that you can redeem to get a random chance or get some form of random outcome in like a Wheel of Fortune style event. And there was all kinds of prizes in there from basically, you just get like a slight percent bonus increase to experience or gold, or you get some cosmetic item, or you get like a skilling item or something that as you use it, you get like a percent XP modifier kind of thing. And then they also put in flat XP lamps into that rotation as well, which was quite polarizing at the time. So that was just an item that when you used it, you just got a certain amount of experience in the skill of your choice or in a particular skill. And it just instantly gave you those experience points in that skill. So, in theory, what this meant you could do was essentially buy a lot of these tokens or tickets to spin the Wheel of Fortune or the Squeal of Fortune as it was. And well, over time, given enough spins, you would accrue a shitload of these experience lamps. And in theory, if you spent enough money, you could basically max your account just by using these lamps that you got from this. It would cost a shitload of money, but in theory, you could do it. Now, these sorts of games attract a certain type of player over others, which is essentially a min-maxed kind of nerd or like a most efficient way to do things playstyle. And essentially what that means was the meta or the best, most efficient way to level your account was to do this method. Albeit it would require a shitload of in real life money, it was still essentially the fastest way to level an account. And because of that, the meta for leveling an account the fastest is essentially to basically get another job so you can get more money so that you can not play the game and instead just cash into the game to buy the experience to level your account. So, in essence, the most optimal way to play the game in this scenario was to not play the game and to spend your time doing other things outside of the game to earn money, to spend in-game, to level up your account. Taking this concept back to actually playing the game of Magic, there exists a deck archetype in Magic called Dredge. What Dredge does is it doesn't play Magic in the same way that a normal deck would, and instead it focuses on moving cards directly from your deck into your graveyard, which is normally considered a lose condition, from the what's called milling a library or milling a deck, which is a win condition from a normal deck type. A normal mill deck would try to do that to an opponent, but Dredge tries to win the game by doing it to themselves, by moving the cards directly from their library or their deck into their graveyard, and then essentially by playing these really weird out of game cards that do something when they move from the deck or the library into the graveyard. They essentially get an advantage by putting by playing them, and then they essentially get free creatures by doing nothing, and then they will use those creatures as fuel to do something, either reanimate a win condition or create a shitload of zombies or something to that effect, and then they will do all of that whether very rarely by casting spells or by actually interacting with the game, which makes it a deck that plays and wins by not playing and by winning. So in Magic, you have this group of cards called a sideboard, which is normally 15 cards. And what that sideboard allows you to do is to, in between games and a round, you can chop and change your deck by substituting any of those 15 cards into your deck. And it just means that you have answers to things that your deck normally wouldn't. So normally your deck of 60 cards, you keep it really clean at 60 cards because you want to draw your key cards that win the game. And normally in that 60 cards, you keep it as a very well fine-tuned engine so that it can, as quickly as possible, you draw the cards you need to set up your game state or whatever so that you can win the game as soon as possible. And then after game one, your sideboard allows you or gives you access to extra answers to things that your opponent might be using to win or to accelerate their game state into a place that they can win. So you might have stuff in there that blows up artifacts or stops you from being targeted by certain things or protects your creatures or maybe counter spells or just stuff that you can use to help yourself to not lose quicker so that you can win and your opponent cannot win. And in a lot of scenarios, any format where Dredge is legal, you will dedicate a significant portion of your sideboard to fighting it, just purely because it's such an oppressive deck to try to deal with if you aren't using very niche graveyard hate cards or very specific narrow cards that do very specific things. So as a result of that, a lot of people occupy a lot of their sideboard to dealing with Dredge in those formats. So we talked about how to win games of Magic by not playing Magic, how to win, essentially, RuneScape by not playing RuneScape. How do we win life without playing life? Well, we already talked about bribery and corruption, so we may as well stick with that. You can essentially, if you had enough money, you could acquire things that most people could not, like people's position and attitude and their opinions and media and stuff like that. And on the same note of being competitive by not being competitive, we also have the concept of clustering similar businesses together. So what happens is some analysts will look at a new region or a new place or location or whatever to put their new store. Say there's like a beachfront section somewhere and they want to sell like soda and candy bars or something like that. So what happens is you have the most popular area of the beach and you want to be as close to that as possible, right? So you'll have your zone, you'll have your ideal spot to be, and typically that will be at the halfway point so that you can attract the most number of customers from that biggest area. So you'll put your store smack bang in the middle of your target area so that the most people can gain access to that. That's fantastic. And now a competitor sees you put up a store there and they're like, hey, we want to do that. We do the same thing. We look at the same demographic. Let's put our store up. They take a look at the same scenario and they deduce, based on the same as you, that to attract the most number of customers, they want to put it bang smack in the middle. Hence, right next door to you, they erect a store which is pretty much the same as you, selling the same products to the same customers. So while this makes absolutely no sense when you look at it as a neutral outside observer and you're like, what the fuck, there's two pizza stores right next to each other, or two soda stalls at a beach or something like that, or two vending machines which sell the exact same shit, or anything of that degree, you have to bear in mind that this has been targeted based on their optimal audience and their ability to reach the most of their target demographics. So it's based on proximity to customers and probably very, very small consideration of proximity to competitors, because either way they have to go to one of you. So yeah, putting it right next door to the other is not going to be a factor in that decision, really, right? And this also factors into franchises and what their motivations are to allow you access to the franchise. So, there's some franchises out there or some chain stores that aren't specifically focused on selling product. Examples of this would be like McDonald's or Subway, where the emphasis is more around store location and essentially having more stores or getting stores in higher real estate value areas, or having store access in certain areas, or just in Subway's case, just having as many Subways as possible so that they can make bank on franchisee fees and stuff like that. So it's not always going to be in the franchise's best interests to make sure that there's only one store in a particular area. In some cases, they might want as many stores as possible so that they can make bank off your decision. Another example of anti-competitive competitiveness is in corporations or applying for jobs. So in general, what you want to do is sound professional, essentially, which because of that you end up emphasizing certain words and terms, and the whole act of trying to stand out means that instead you're actually guiding yourself to a representation that looks very similar to basically everyone else, because everyone else is trying to stand out in the exact same way that you are, so you all look the same. The most prominent example I can think of for doing this is with election campaigns and the propaganda or advertising associated with it. Now, what most campaigners do these days is, well, pretty much everyone will have a sign that looks exactly the same. The only difference is the coloring and the face, basically. So all the signs will be identical. They will just have the political party's name, some branding or slogan or whatever, and most importantly, they will all have a little tick on them. Now, the idea of the tick, probably props to the first guy who thought of it, was so that you psychologically associate that party with putting the tick in the box on the voting form. So for the first guy to do this, it probably made a shitload of sense and it would have given him an advantage. But now, because everyone does it, it means that no one stands out. But you kind of have to do it, because if you don't, you're losing that edge. So pretty much everyone just does it because. And again, with the placement thing, you often see all the signs clustered very closely together, much for a very similar reason of the most amount of people being, well, getting exposure to it. And if we think about the win conditions behind the game or the exercise or the advertising campaign or what have you, there's always more than one way to meet a win condition or more than one pathway to achieve that win condition. So even if, in the case of StarCraft or where basically you just want to remove your opponent from the game by eliminating all the units, or something like, or chess, for example, where you want to place the opponent into checkmate by making their king unable to defend themselves. So you could take the conventional approach of positioning yourself as best as possible and making all the best decisions that you can, and being an experienced player and being familiar with the game and thinking about moves critically and in advance and on different layers and all that jazz. Or alternatively, you can also work at removing your opponent's ability to do that and to create a bigger disparity between you and your opponent's value or efficiency of play. The most extreme example being physically removing the player from the game somehow and winning due to a concession. So if your opponent physically isn't able to play, then you kind of win, right? So essentially, what we have is, instead of the best defense being a great offense, is we have the best offense is to not play the game or to completely bypass the conventional win condition or to at least shortcut it entirely. And a byproduct of this is often either a catch-22 scenario or some form of outcome which is neither most perfectly advantageous to either party, as is the case of whacking a store right next to your competitor, but it's a case of lowering the edge that your competitor gets so that you can get a margin in. Typically, the win condition associated with capitalism and doing business is to just turn over a profit to make money. And to solidify a margin of some kind, so long as you're making money and you're not incurring expense instead, why not? In old school RuneScape, there used to be an area of the game called the Revenant Caves, and this was an area in kind of higher level wilderness, which is the PvP area, and inside the caves you could PvP as well. And what ended up happening was essentially there would be clans or groups of people that would essentially control areas inside the Rev Caves or permit or deny access to it by attacking people who they did not approve of, who were in the area. So basically, big groups of PvPers who would regulate and racketeer certain worlds or what have you. So there's like a couple of hundred game servers or whatever worlds, and you would need to safely use the Rift Caves, you would need to pay a protection clan, and they would allow you to kill creatures in there for a certain period of time based on how much you paid. And basically, if someone came to kill you, you would yell out to them, and then they would jump to your world and kill them. And they would offer you protection, which was more often than not protection from them to not kill you. So more like a blackmail rather than a protection fee against others, like a bodyguard service. So originally, this started off with already existing PvP clans wanting to make a bit more money and have a bit more fun by allowing people to buy their services in this way, and they would just hop through worlds and make sure that on their worlds there was no one there who hadn't been paying, otherwise they would kill them and take their stuff. What ended up happening was over time this slowly evolved, and those PKing groups started to acquire more and more Venezuelan players who were desperate to get into that excess of money, so that they could real world trade it for their own benefit of getting food on the table. And then after a while, what ended up happening was a lot of these protection clans were vastly populated by Venezuelan players. At a critical point, what ended up happening was the Venezuelan run at the time, then protection clans essentially formed a conglomerate group or organization of essentially like a super clan of just Venezuelans, and they kind of went a bit rogue and started using the Rev Caves for their own gain. And then after a while, what ended up happening was the original PKing clans needed to essentially take back control from the Venezuelan-run resistance group, essentially. And there was a massive fight out there, but yeah, it was pretty bad. And then soon after this, there was a massive rework into the types of PvP you could do at the Rev Caves, which just changed everything, LML. And they also nerfed the gold per hour that you could get, so it was no longer a super profitable thing to do. The types of PvP changed drastically to what's called Singles Plus, away from multi-combat. And in Singles Plus, it's PvE until someone tries to attack you, and then only that one person can attack you, essentially. So what have we got today? We have optimal ways to play games by not playing games the way that other people consider optimal. We've got corruption and bribery being the best ways to play games, or other ways to distract or disarm your opponents or make them less efficient as an alternative to creating a pathway to a win condition. And then finally, essentially, if you can't beat them, join them mentality. Or if I go down, I'm taking you with me, or nice profits you got there, I want to cut capitalism style mentality. So, yeah, basically, think twice why you play a game and how not only you can win, but other people can lose. There's more than one pathway to a win condition. See ya.